Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined by Bruce Morton and Simon Bradbury of Allegis Global Solutions. Bruce is Head of Strategy at Allegis Global Solutions, and Simon is VP for the EMEA region with responsibility for business development and operations. Gents, you've also recently co-authored the Universal Workforce Model. Congratulations to you both. Really enjoyed the book. I think it's very interesting. For our listeners, it was published in May of this year, so if you haven't bought it, really recommend you having a look at it. So, gentlemen, how are you doing today? Are you both keeping well?
Great. Thanks, Conor. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to see you, Conor. All good here. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, guys, it's a real pleasure to have you both on the show. So, I guess my first question, guys, it might seem like an obvious one, but sure, we'll ask it anyway. What made you both decide to write the book, which is called The Universal Workforce Model?
Yeah, well, Simon, it was your idea, so I'll let you take that one and I'll pile on.
So, Conor, it was May about 18 months ago, and Bruce and I had been working for nearly a year at that point with the leadership team at AGS on the future of work, on the existing models we were deploying, about how we thought they, what they might look like in the future, and actually, you know, being driven by the fact that we think there's a better way. And we spent quite some time figuring out the detail and also understanding the deployment of, okay, so here's the matching the theory to the practice. We see ourselves as practitioners, essentially. Bruce, obviously, clearly a strategist day to day. And Bruce had written a book previously. And I thought this would be a great opportunity to put a marker down and say to people, hey, what about this? Because we knew what we wanted to say. And I thought Bruce would be a great partner in that, an avenue to getting some credibility around what we could actually put down. And it was Bruce's idea to bring in John Boudreau very early, who's obviously like the world's leading academic and workforce, to give credibility. And I can say we probably fleshed out the initial scan of 10 chapters, which I think in editing moved to 11 chapters, but we did that in about a minute. And then the process moved on from there. But it was really, we feel it's an industry that hasn't changed that much for 20 plus years. We feel that the reality of delivery doesn't meet clients' needs and expectations. And we wanted to articulate what that could look like in practice. Bruce, anything to add to that?
No, I think you summed that up really well.
I love it, guys. And I have to say, it was a great read. And I think it's refreshing to hear from what I would describe as the solution side or the sell side in our sector about what can be done differently. I think oftentimes we rely on Deloitte, McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group. And it's really great to read such an interesting work from our sector, as I would describe it. So well done to you both, guys. And I think just before we get into it, guys, I'd love to hear a bit about, and I'm sure our listeners would too, I'm sure all of our listeners know who Allegis Global Solutions are, but Bruce, would you mind just describing for our audience how you got into the workforce solution space? And Simon, I'll come on to you in a second as well.
Yeah, so 1980, some people listening probably weren't born then, I walked into a employment agency, as they were called at the time, looking for a job. I'd been a butcher up to that point and broke my back, so I couldn't be a butcher anymore. So I thought I'd better go and get a sales job I was looking for. And the first agency I walked into, they're like, well, you seem quite sharp. Can you pick up a phone? Can you read the yellow pages? Can you start Monday? And that was it, 42 odd years ago. I'm in my 43rd year now. So, and I think, interesting, at a conference that you and I both attended last week, one of the speakers asked, hands up, who chose recruitment or staffing as a career, not one hand went up. So I think back in the day you fell into it. But it's been very, very kind to me. It's taken me all over the world. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But yeah, that's how I got into it nearly 43 years ago.
Wow. Bruce, I think this is one of the reasons I love doing this show, actually. The range of varied answers to that question is top notch. So I have to say, mate, that was one of the more interesting answers, I have to say. We had a really cool lady on, actually, some weeks ago, the CEO of a platform called WeDo, and her background was a successful rock star divorcee is basically how I would describe her. Who basically immigrated to the south of France and set up all these pre-Spotify type businesses. But Simon, same question to you. What was your journey into the workforce solution space? Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, I'm much more of a newcomer. I was 92, so just over 30 years ago. Very similar story. I've actually only ever met one person who was someone I used to work with in India, who said, actually, I always planned to work in the recruitment industry. By the way, through university, that's what I always wanted to do. I've literally won. I went to London School of Economics. Everyone there goes into banking, everyone. And I went to a recruitment agency to get a job in a bank. And they said to me, you don't want to work in a bank. You want to work for us. And I was like, do I? And I thought I'd do it for 6 months and then get a proper job. I was at that company for 18 years. I think probably the slightly more interesting bit about my career is that I fell out of love with it a little bit after 18 years and went to work for Deloitte in HR consulting, and was a director in the HR consulting practice in London. Fantastic job, great exposure. But I tell you what, I missed recruitment. And I came back after 18 months because I wanted to get back into the industry. I missed the buzz, I missed the environment, and it's really interesting. It's something we should all cherish because it is a fantastic industry to work in.
Yeah, I agree with you both, Jen. So I feel bad saying this. I came into the sector quite late then, I suppose, compared to you guys. I'm saying back in 2007, but that's relatively recently. But like you, gents, I had a furry background. I actually weirdly left a career as a lawyer and to become a recruiter. And I wasn't aware I was becoming a recruiter. This is how naive I was. I actually thought I was going to be some sort of pseudo stockbroker. And that was there was some truth to it in a way. I suppose we did trade people a bit like barrels of oil, but anyway, that was a long time ago for myself. But
if I may just one quick question on this point what you're talking about. We've been doing like book clubs internally and that kind of thing, and one of the questions we get asked is how long did it take to write? And this one of these answers where I said, well, actually it took 6 weeks. It took 3 weeks us to write the first draft, and it took another 3 weeks to edit it among peer edit it between us, and the rest of it was group editing. And Bruce went, that's not right. It took us 72 years. That's how much experience went into. I have to say, I prefer Bruce's answer to mine.
It just shows you, though, that need for speed that us former or current recruiters have. So I guess, guys, let's delve into the book some more. I know, Simon, you outlined the reasons why you decided both to co-author and write the book. But I guess, would you mind digging in a bit and defining, in your view, what is the universal workforce model, firstly? And then secondly, what can organizations do to implement it successfully?
Yeah, let me start there. So one of the reasons, as Simon mentioned earlier, we wanted to put a flag in the ground, put a stake in the ground, was that for many, many years, people have been talking about total talent acquisition, total talent management. But it's one of those, you put 100 people in the room, you get 100 different answers. So from the outset, we said, well, total talent obviously hasn't worked because people have been talking about it for 20 odd years and we haven't seen any changes. A lot of that was the tech platforms hadn't really delivered on that promise of being able to manage employees and non-employees. That was one of the reasons. So as from the outset, and this is some of the work we were doing with John Boudreau, was that let's define this. What do we mean? So the three core elements make it very, very simple. Number one is a task-first approach. So you think about the work itself as opposed to the job description. most conversations that happen inside organizations and inside staffing companies is it's all about that job spec and the person spec they send you. So step one is to start with the work, not the job description, deconstruct that work into tasks, and then have that conversation about task by task, what is the best way to get that task done? Is it to automate it? Should I use employees? Can I use contractors? Can I bundle this thing up, put a price label on it, and pitch it out to a service provider or even onto a talent platform? By the role, by the work itself, and then deconstruct into tasks. So step one, that task-first approach. The second thing is the concept of what we call the workforce business partner. And the best analogy I can use for a workforce business partner is in the construction industry, we have a quantity surveyor. So they pick up an architect's drawing of a house, let's say the blueprint, and they can tell through their expertise and their knowledge how many bricks you need to buy, how much cement, how much cabling, what order you need to do things in, the amount of labor that you need, how long it will take, and how much it should cost. If you take that concept and put it into the world of work, that's what a workforce business partner's role is. So this is somebody that a business head, the lead, would go to that individual, not for day-to-day. We call it, if it went transcends the transactional, in other words, it's bigger than just day-to-day. Mary left, I need another Mary. This is more about, here's a piece of work I need to get done. They have the conversation with the workforce business partner. They go through that process of deconstructing, thinking about the best way to get each element, and that gives you your resource plan, if you like. So that's an individual that needs to understand how to get work done and needs to understand that organization and probably needs to understand that function as well. So we see in the future, large organization will have a workforce business partner for marketing, for sales and marketing, one for finance, one in tech, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third piece, which without the third piece, nothing happens, is the technology platform. And we've been, as I mentioned earlier, sort of hoping and praying and looking into the market for the silver bullet of technology, and it just wasn't coming. So we made a big decision, and this is back in 2018, to build our own. So that's what we've done. It's what we're still doing. It's continuing to evolve. But this is the technology, which we call an intelligent workforce platform, is where all of your employees sit, all of your suppliers' performance, all of your suppliers' people, if you get access to them, all of the market data. So we partner with organizations like Brightfield, the TDX product, formerly MZ, now Lightcast. So you've got all that external data and all the internal data, which gives the ability to match people with jobs all in one place. So it isn't about replacing the ATS or the CRM or the HRIS. It's about the foundation or the window into those. So we say very simply, if you have those three things, you are operating in a universal workforce model arena. If you have two out of the three, you're not. So hopefully, that was quite a long answer, but I was trying to keep it fairly simple. So hopefully that answered that.
Yeah, so spot on, Bruce. That's clear. And I think there's a beautiful simplicity to what you gentlemen have outlined in your book. And if it's okay, guys, I just want to look at that second point that relates to, I think it transcends, what was the phrase, Brooke?
It transcends the transactional.
Transcends the transactional, because I think, I look at my own organization and I'm probably critical there first, but I think what I'm about to say is almost a universal problem that maybe the universal workforce model can solve. But it relates, guys, to resource demand planning. If you think about it, the benefit of workforce companies like yours and like mine and ours and recruiters is that we can solve a particular problem when it comes to matching a resource requirement or demand with supply, and using our expertise and our technology to marry that supply with the demand. But if you think about it, resource demand planning is typically done pretty badly. Instead of first in time or even just in time, it gets to the delivery point last in time, right? You're scrambling for resources typically at the last minute. And I think that workforce business partner approach that you have outlined certainly would solve some of that problem. But gents, does your technology or your approach solve for the resource demand planning?
It does, yeah. Let me throw it to Simon. So, yeah, Simon, go for it.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. So the starting point where we think the whole industry has gone wrong is directly related to the point that you're addressing, Connor, and talks to why we did this and also talks to how we want to change things going forward. And the reason why we, or not the only reason, but the primary reason why we get this challenge about matching resources to demand is that I'm going to oversimplify here, but there are three silos. There's permanent resources within the workforce. There's permanent resources. There's non-permanent staff augmentation, contingent resources. And then there's kind of outsourced statement of work, consultancy resources. It's more complex than that, but that's the headline. The first thing that you do when you need to match, you know, find someone in the workforce, get something done, is you say to the person in the business, which one of these three paths do you want to go down? And are you looking for a permanent person? Are you looking for a contingent worker? Are you looking for a statement of work or a consultant? And the reason we do that is that we've got completely different mechanisms internally to, you know, sign off approval systems, different teams, you know, different people you would speak to and actually execute that for you. That, if you do that, you've already lost, okay? And the reason that you've already lost is because the answer may well not be, well, I just need to replace Mary because Mary's left, as Bruce was alluding to. It might not even be just one of those in individual. It might be a hybrid solution. It might be, yeah, well, hang on a minute. We could get some permanent people to do this because they'd be really useful. We might need some consultancy advice in this, but actually we could have some contractors in it. Who knows? Right? And the point, the reason why it breaks down is that we are instantly into the world of we've made the wrong decision before we've even started. And actually we're asking someone to make a decision who isn't qualified or hasn't had the knowledge to make that decision. So that's why this kind of point of workforce business partner, you also hear us talk about harmonization. It's basically about bringing together the different channels and access to the workforce, the workforce in its broadest possible sense, to be able to get work done in the best possible way and consider all options. And indeed, it was precisely that marrying together the last two bits that you two gentlemen have talked about. It was our, when Bruce said we were looking for something in the marketplace, we were looking for the technology that could do that. We said we understood the problem. We understood what the solution was, but we knew, and we were aware of organizations, by the way, that had tried it and failed. Because imagine you're doing that role. Imagine you're doing that job. Manager's going to come to you and they're going to say, well, what are my options? Well, even if you're just working for one business area, that means that you've got to understand the external marketplace, understand different geographies, understand how we've done that previously, understand what's happening in the contingent workforce, understand what consultancies would be good. What chance do you have? Okay, well, you do have a chance if you have a piece of technology that aggregates data, both internal and externally, and that's why we define the Intelligent Workforce Platform. Now, we because we felt there was something out there, we've been developing and working on our own as well, but only because the necessity's there. And we felt that there was a need to do that. And do I think that we've got today a piece of technology that has all the answers to every single question? No, we haven't. Do I think we've got something that is able to map, not just answer those initial questions, but be able to figure out like kind of resource planning rather than strategic workforce planning? Absolutely. And that can do much more of a strategic kind of response to a business requirements. And before I have it, just one other quick thing. Of the three points that Bruce made, which are the three critical points in universal workforce model: tasks, not jobs, workforce business partner, stroke harmonization, and a technology platform. There is actually a logical step of 1, 2, 3, which I think helps people understand. The first thing is this starting point of silos, And basically trying to hire someone by, well, how have we done it before? And I need to make a decision as to which channel I'm going down. And whereas actually it's far better to say, what are you trying to achieve here? And let's keep our options open and consider it. And there's lots of case studies and examples of how this works. And this is why John Boudreau is so mission critical to this, because all the academic theory basically backs up that kind of this approach of tasks, not jobs. What do you need to get done? Not who you're trying to hire. Don't start with the job spec. All the same thing. If you accept that, and I think it's pretty hard to reject that, but if you accept that, it follows as a matter of logic that you have to harmonize your channels. Because if you don't harmonize your channels, and we call that having a workforce business partner, but if you don't harmonize your channels, you are forever saying, which channel do you want to go down first? You're forever starting there and you've lost. And if you then accept that you've got to harmonize your channels, it follows as a matter of logic that you have to have a technology platform to make that job a reality. So actually, it isn't kind of three crazy out there ideas. You start with the fact that how do you get work done and understanding the task, not the job, is a better way for an enterprise, it's a more productive way for an enterprise to operate. And then two and three follow as a matter of logic from that, and it's an inescapable conclusion.
Yeah, I Simon, Bruce, I completely subscribe to what you've both just outlined. I have been praying, I really have, and I think we've done nearly 70 shows now, and we've talked about having this single view of an organization's talent and the talent available to that organization, whether it's on a task base, whether it's a permanent, whether it's a reskill, whether it's outsource, insource. And it's great to hear that you guys not only have went on that journey, but you've got something that potentially or does give you that single view, right? And I think that's what we've so missed in our sector over the years. We've got all these disparate sources of talent. We've got all these disparate systems, ATS, VMS, HRIS, the list. Listen, it's acronym central, right? We all know this. But I think what you guys have described and done is bloody brilliant. So with talent being on, I think, pretty much every senior executive's agenda, if you consider the most recent reports from PwC, they did a survey of 700 C-level executives. They said talent was either their number one or number two priority. I guess this has been a great time for you guys to go to your clients or potentially other enterprises and say, hey, you want to have a look? This is what we got. But I guess in your view and your experience, guys, what can organizations do to go on this journey? What advice can we and you give them to start this process and start this journey?
Yes, it's a great question, Connor, and it is the key to it because, you know, Simon mentioned harmonization. This, you have to get, let's say, the C-suite, but you have to get all of your senior leadership on board with this. If this remains an HR initiative or procurement initiative, pretty slim chance of getting it across the line long term. It'll just become an initiative, and that's not knocking either of those professions. Those are 99% of our clients, you know, tend to be in procurement or HR. But you have to get the attention of the board, get everybody understanding it's a business initiative, and then go on the journey together. And it is a journey. You know, we believe, you know, probably a 2 to 5 year journey to get to, probably never end, but 2 to 5 years is probably the expectation of being in this type of world. So as we think about that, we created, because we realized that this is a massive, massive leap for organizations to take, and they need somebody to hold the hand. So we created what we call the Workforce Maturity Diagnostic, which is a pretty complex, very deep understanding of where that organization is right now and where they want to be or where they need to be, because that's very specific, and level of urgency around it for things. And there's many, many points of data, and this is done through it's interviews with the senior leadership and then surveying, you know, the hiring managers, line managers across an organization, more of an online survey that gives you those two comparisons, as well as gives you then we then turn that into a target operating model, which is a, you know, for want of a better word, a strategic roadmap to get there. So we, you know, as an organization and for our clients, we operate in a run, grow, transform methodology. This is about getting today fixed, and then how do we grow value inside that program, and then how do we get to a transformation? It's not a flicker switch. So we've created those tools to help organizations, because I think the biggest response we got is, yeah, this makes sense. Where the heck do I start? So we've created that, where here's how you know where to start, because the answers unearth that journey of where to go and what that path will be to get to that North Star.
Love it, Bruce. Thanks very much. Simon, anything to add on that?
Yeah, well, just kind of one thing I would say that's interesting. You alluded, or you mentioned when in kind of your opening comments, that, you know, we've been as an industry, we've probably been lectured a bit by some of the big four consultancies, plus maybe McKinsey and et cetera, whatever, whoever that may be. And of course, I have done a little bit of work in that sector myself. And one of the things I noticed is, I thought, well, I'll tell you what, I know that clients will pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for advice from an organization that has nowhere near the expertise that companies like us have. And it's not just Allegis, but there's other companies, and some of our competitors have got amazing internal expertise as well. But so we really want to fix that. But there is a, what that underlines is that there is a global a disconnect between executive boards strategically who want to achieve something with their workforce, and then practically the practitioners that are doing stuff on the ground, be they internal or be they external. And actually, we wrote the book. It's intentionally short, right? We said each chapter had to be less than 1,500 words. It had to be less than 100 pages. It's about a four-hour read. It has to be easy to read, because what we wanted to do is we wanted this to be bridging the gap between those executives and the practitioners, so that actually was a way of the because, again, in fact, the first chapter of the book talks about a similar survey to the one that you just quoted, but probably a year old now, and but same principle, right? which is that this is the number one issue, but then how are they why is no one fixing it? Well it takes it if it is that high priority, we've got to accept that there's a gap that's got to be bridged. We've got to be able to speak in the language that executives understand, and that includes from a theoretical perspective. And going back to Bruce's point, just trying to join up a few dots here, Bruce talked about transcending the transactional. An HR structure, your classic Ulrich HR model, has within it, you know, HR business partners, HR operations, and a centre of expertise. What we're essentially saying here is that within workforce, you need to elevate the value and responsibility of workforce within that structure. Have a workforce business partner who is a deep expert of workforce in a particular area, but they're dealing with the areas that transcend the transactional in exactly the same way that an HR business partner deals with HR issues that transcend the transactional. They do not deal with transactional HR issues, such as I'm updating my pension details or payroll needs to have this bit of information or whatever it might be. That's dealt with HR operations or the HR shared service center. So actually the model here, we don't really go into the transactional element in the book itself, but the practical application of the model fits in beautifully with an HR structure that executives will understand. But it's not just the principle of we've got to have that conversation. We've got to actually be able to speak the language so that it all makes sense across the board.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Simon. It does intrigue and interest me that the sort of blue chip consulting organizations are coming into what I consider our space. You know, I did reference McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, and I suppose where there's volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, those organizations obviously have a great part to play. They advise the C-level on those sort of strategic problems. But it's interesting that practitioners and solution providers like ourselves, often, to Bruce's earlier point, it's the HR and procurement people that really want to speak to us. And we love speaking to them. Of course we do. But it's very rare, at least in my career, where the CEO of a company has picked up the phone and said, listen, come in and talk to me about some of the strategic dilemmas we're grappling with around talent. You know, BCG or McKinsey or EY are probably the first number to call. But I think with books and the approach and the technology that you guys have created, I think that's going to help change that paradigm. And I really hope so, because I feel that we should be elevated in our sector and that we do have a really important part to play. And if I could just say this, guys, I'll get off my soapbox, I'm sure you'll be glad of in a second. But I noticed this trend, actually. It wasn't just with the COVID pandemic and the labour scarcity and the salary inflation. I remember going to a pitch with the UK's leading telecommunication company about seven years ago, right? And I was talking to the procurement folks. We were having a bit of fun, you know, as you do at the beginning of the meeting. Well, that's how I do it anyway. But they were saying, yeah, yesterday we had EY in here talking to us about the very same thing. Obviously, that encroachment is continuing. But guys, I'm loving the conversation. I feel so privileged to be doing the show and listening and speaking to guys like yourself with this rich degree of expertise. And I want to come on to something. It's not particularly new, guys. I thought it would have went away by now. It's been described by the following publications, the Financial Times, The Economist, The Bloomberg, more recently by PwC and the World Employment Confederation, as the labour market paradox. There was an interesting research paper put out at the beginning of 2021 about this. And in short, what it was saying was there's been loads of people, workers, displaced from their jobs. Yet there's never been more jobs or more companies hiring than ever before, right? So you've got this great mismatch, particularly in the Western developed economies, between demand for labor, to use such a crude term, and supply. So I guess my question is really twofold, guys, and I appreciate it's been described as the labor market paradox, so we might not solve it on this show, but let's give it a go. So first question to you both is, in your view, gents, why do you think the labor market paradox has occurred or arisen? That's question number one. And then the second question is, in your view, gents, what can be done to solve for this labor market paradox, or at least solve part of the problem as you may see it?
Yeah, I think I'll kick off at a macro level. We have enough people on the planet to do the jobs that are open. It's just they're in the wrong place. You mentioned, so my soapbox is, and has been for many years, is, you know, a third of the world's working population live in Africa. And we haven't found a way of sending work there. I'm generalizing, of course, for effect. Now, people will say, yeah, there's the corruption, there's the lack of infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. We said that about what we now call APAC 40 years ago. But we got over it. We got over ourselves and started sending work there, you know, through labor arbitrage. If you think about, you know, two of the top 20 universities in the world now are in Africa. So they're on the journey. It's going to happen. Hopefully it happens in my lifetime. But that's one thing. Sometimes we're looking in the wrong place, but we're looking too narrowly. The other point, I mean, in the US alone, as of last week, if everybody came back to work that could come back to work, we still have 5.5 million jobs unfilled. So this isn't hyperbole. This is reality. And, if you look at what's happening right now with inflation around the world, a lot of that's in the service industry has been caused by a hike in wages. Now, products pricing, you know, good pricing have gone up because of this supply chain aftermath of COVID. There's a chance of them leveling out. People are now finally earning in the US the $15 an hour. You know, we've been fighting over minimum wage and it sort of happened. You know, McDonald's paying a $5,000, hiring bonus. So those prices, we better get used to them. If there's service involved and there's human beings involved, they're getting paid more now than they were. Therefore, those prices aren't going to go backwards. So that's part of that inflationary impact that's happening. But I think when it comes to, you know, how do we solve it? I think that there's a lot needs to be done at a governmental and political level. You know, here in the US, we're struggling to, you know, have people work on farms at the same time as stopping people come in to work on the farms. You know, I don't want to get political about that, but that it sort of seems a bit crazy. But I think the starting point where we see it at a far more of a micro level inside an organization, take one organization, is you're asking the wrong question. You keep going out to market to bring more talent in. Stop, take a breath. Let's think about the way you get work done. Start with that, have that conversation. There might be a better way. You know, we live in this world where all of the big tech companies, 3 weeks ago now, laid off 11,000 here, 20,000 there. Unemployment went down that same week. So it isn't like all of a sudden these people are on the market and our problems are over. They've been snapped up very, very quickly. So I think the answer is not just keep going to market for more talent. I think internal mobility will be massive in 2023. And one of the starting points of that, if you like, is the whole internal gig economy. How do you open up opportunities and projects to your own workforce to give them stretch assignments and so on and so forth? That might diminish the need then to just keep going and hire more people. So there was a lot there, but that was just a stream of thought there. But I'll hand over to Simon.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, and Connor, I think you said what caused it. So
yes,
people have exited the workforce. I mean, post pandemic, and you know, there's lots of different data points out there in terms of what's caused it, but it seems to be slightly disproportionate for older people. People made a choice that they don't feel they want to work anymore, and it doesn't take that big a percentage an opportunity for people to drop out of the workforce. It's, depending on your age category, it's 5 to 10% typically in different economies, but it seems to be pretty, you know, across most Western economies. But that number drops out, it causes you a massive structural problem in terms of getting work done and employing people. So it's the pandemic that's driven people falling out of the workforce that's driven the, you know, the crisis that we've got at the moment. I think paradox is the wrong word, because it isn't truly a paradox. We know what the problem is. People have rejected the workforce, and it's just a supply and demand issue, right? So there's that. I'm going to steal Bruce's thunder a little bit here, because I'm going to give a micro example that just illustrates everything that he's just said, and hopefully bringing it to life, make it real for people. We work, and the reason I feel bad is that Bruce did the work on this rather than me, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. At least I'm declaring it, Bruce. So we've got a client, massive healthcare organisation, hires thousands and thousands of nurses, cannot achieve its corporate enterprise objectives from an investor perspective, because the cost of a core resource is just spiraling up and up and up, because there are not enough nurses in the marketplace to do what they need to do. And if they keep going the way they're going, the cost of getting of doing the work is going to be prohibitively expensive for them, and they're never going to be able to achieve their profit goals. So their long-term objectives are out the window, right? It's that serious. This is not an HR issue, right? This is an enterprise-wide corporate issue. Deconstruction sounds like a kind of ephemeral, or what's that? Okay. What it meant was, we said, well, hang on, let's look at what the nurse's job is. And to cut a long story short, by deconstructing the tasks that the nurses were actually doing, and it did vary a bit in role to role, but the headline is that 30% of the role that the nurses were doing were actually stuff that you needed to be a qualified nurse to do. So this is where we come back to how do you get work done, starting in the wrong place. The issue wasn't they couldn't hire enough nurses. The issue was they were trying to hire three times as many nurses as they needed. Okay? And then what you do is you say, okay, well, let's redesign the nurse's job spec. So now the nurses are happier because they're no longer doing reception duties. They're no longer taking temperatures, which you don't need to be a qualified nurse to do. They're no longer booking and scheduling appointments, which can be automated. So then their role is better, and their retention of those increases significantly. You automate, so you take cost out, and you increase, you're able to give additional tasks to other people who are in roles that are easier to find. That is getting work done in a different way. That is a task approach. That is deconstruction in reality. Now, just imagine that we were to do that with the workforce. Now, we've done it in other areas. The reason we pick that more than once, because it's the most extreme example we've come across. But in every job we look at, it's probably somewhere between 70 and 85% of the role that, you know, expensive people, they're only doing a certain proportion of that role. You can easily see efficiency opportunities. Well, if we're working 25 to 30% inefficiently because people are doing the wrong sorts of tasks they're qualified to do, and we wonder why they keep leaving, and the whole issue is caused by 5 to 10% of the workforce leaving, we actually can solve this problem by looking at tasks, not jobs. Okay, but you've got to understand the infrastructure there. So I just wanted to come at it from that point of view and give an illustrative example.
Yeah, guys, I think you've both raised a number of what I would describe as intriguing points. Bruce, I've got a bit of a soapbox about Africa. I guess I would describe it, and this sounds like a weird thing to say, but almost as the forgotten continent when it comes to being a really amazing talent pool. And if you think about it in the context of demographics, by 2050, there's forecasted to be 240 million people in Nigeria, which will be more than the population of the European continent, right? And if you look at the Western major markets, the economies there, they've got a declining demographic, not a rising one. So you've got this huge, potentially great talent pool that can support economies remotely from Africa, right? And I think there's a huge market opportunity there to match that amazing supply with demand. If people could be open to tasks or jobs or roles on a remote basis, I think that can really solve things there. And I follow the universities there quite closely as well, Bruce. And I've noted that there's great universities for technology in Nigeria, obviously, but also in places like Kenya, also in places like Rwanda. And I've noticed a number of the job matching platforms come into the market. You might have seen Andela, headquartered out of the United States, and then GoodTalent.io, headquartered out of the United Kingdom, that matches African-based talent remotely with opportunities globally. And I think it's a really smashing market opportunity, number one, but also the ability to start leveling up If we can help people in Africa get better jobs or better tasks and better money, then that's for the good, while still doing good on the other side of the equation. So I think that's quite an interesting market, and I'd love to talk more on that. Bruce, maybe get you on another show to talk about that in depth. But I think you're really onto something there for a host of good reasons, commercial and humanitarian, which is great, Simon. But Simon, that use case or that example that you mentioned was also intriguing to me. And I think I wanted to ask you guys a question. Do you think our schools, our colleges, where we turn out apprentices, universities, and I know not everyone goes to universities, but if you think about a lot of jobs that are advertised, university required, right? Why is that necessary, right? Number one, right? I'd like to get your views on that. And then thinking about it, I think back to school, right? I was given a trigonometry set in like when I was 14. I've never had any call to use that ever since, right? And I bloody hated it at the time. And I remember sitting in school thinking, I'm just interested in history and talking to people, right? But school didn't really cater for that, at least for people like me. And I'm sure if there was people like me, there was other people like me that might have liked trigonometry or might have liked computers. And then I think about how we upskill and reskill people. I think of organizations in the UK like Digital Futures. You know, we know someone there that's doing a great job, guys, I think collectively from our world. And I'm thinking, what is my question? My question to you both really is, do we have a more structural problem when it comes to upskilling and reskilling our people? And do schools do enough to cater for the jobs, not just of today, but the jobs of tomorrow, or the tasks of today and the tasks of tomorrow?
Yeah, I would refer the listeners, if they're interested in that, is to check out Linda Grattan. She's doing some phenomenal work in the Future Work Institute. And Linda, you know, she talks about the 100-year, I can't remember if she calls that, but basically our kids right now are going to live to 100 and plus. And so you're going to be in work 80 years. So number one, you better enjoy the career. And number two, you're probably going to change career a few times in that 80 years. But her whole premise is that right now we have this line of education, then we work, and then we stop work and we die. And it's like a, you know, a single bar chart, let's call it, and the big chunk in the middle is the work. So if you think about that more as a bell curve, so people will stay in education for a much longer period while they're in work, and then at the back end, as they're slowing down, they'll take other interests and start working far more, will have a part-time workforce going forward. You know, people in the 60s, 70s, and 80s will continue to work a little bit and then fill that gap with further education and interests. I wholeheartedly agree with her theory. So I point people there.
And Connor, I would say, so a couple of points here. First of all, I think that the original point around asking for a degree, is that necessary? Well, that is, you know, I mean, the fact that we even hire off job specs and that's where that sort of thing comes from. We shouldn't start with a job spec. It's just the wrong thing to start with. It's not actually a very good predictor of who's going to be successful in a role. Again, I'm just going to give a quick story to bring this to life. When I joined AGS, the first thing I had to do was I had to hire an EA for myself, secretary, and two people, one of whom had done that job before, one of whom who had never done that job before, but the difference between a kind of hiring against the job spec and going, well, have you done this? Have you done this? Have you done this? Have you done this? Yes, I do it now. 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 Versus understanding a predictor of success. But what's really going to be successful in this role is being able to handle difficult conversations with senior people, being able to make judgment calls around prioritization in terms of scenarios, being able to communicate in a way with this difficult situation, those sorts of things. If you ask those questions, which predictors of success, as opposed to ticking off the elements of the job spec, the other person who had never done that particular role goes, yes, I've done that, I can give an example. Yes, I've done that, I can give an example. Yes, I've done that, I can give an example. That's the distinction. And yet, we still, generally speaking, hire in the way that we know doesn't work. Right? So there's definitely a strong element to that. With regards to education, are we setting people up in the right way? Well, I've got two boys. They're 16 and 18. And if there's a video of this, you'll see them behind me. But if there's not a video of it, you won't. I mean, my 18-year-old is the proud owner of a GCSE in ancient Greek, but he didn't do computer studies, right? So he learned so much of what are practical skills from outside of the education system. And the education system is undoubtedly there as a kind of a filter for understanding, you know, and testing a particular academic skill set rather than anything else. And so, I've absolutely no doubt that in terms of is education being used as an opportunity to train people what employers actually need to a very small degree, but it's really more of a filter about academic achievement than it is for actually giving the sort of skills that people need.
That's really interesting to say about your son is upskilling outside of the mainline education system, and that's probably a trend that will continue. So, Simon, you're going to stay on for a bit, Bruce, but you got to go. Is that correct? Yeah, Bruce, thanks so much. Great to see you. And thanks for sharing everything about the universal workforce model. Take care. See you soon.
Great chatting. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. So, Simon, thanks for staying on. Much appreciated. So, Simon, I guess we've covered this already, but I just want to maybe go a bit deeper if we can. In your view, Simon, what tools, techniques, or strategies can you recommend to help organizations cope with some of the talent scarcity problems that they're facing?
So I think the first thing is try and work with the business. So I have a real belief that the way organizations actually practically hire people is you have a process that leads the business, not a business that leads the process. And I think flipping that around is really, really key. So you need to understand what's going to work for a business. And again, that without treading over old ground, that goes back to, you know, having a transactional solution and as well as a non-transactional solution. I think that if we can get some real quick wins, let me give an example of what I think the quick win might be. Well, most major enterprise organizations will spend hundreds of millions of dollars on consulting. And if you ask them anecdotally, how much of that do you think is actually necessary? And how much of it do you think is wasted? Most people, even if they're involved in the procurement of it, will say 25% of it is probably because we just don't know what else to do. And so we go with the most expensive solution because no one's going to get fired for that if we can find the money somehow. And some people say it's much more than that. But very few people would say it's less than 20-25%. Imagine that you could be the rock star in your organization that said, I know how to save 25% of our consulting budget.
Yeah.
And now for many organizations, that's $100 million on its own. Okay. But how do you achieve that? Well, you achieve that by actually understanding how to match people to the roles that need to get done in the first place, rather than having no idea. And the reason we have no idea is because the managers are asked in the first place, who do you want to hire to achieve what you need to achieve? So they go and hire a consultancy. So I really believe that the magic story that is going to act as the catalyst here are the big savings, which we're working on at the moment with organizations, but different organizations are going different places. Is for someone to be able to turn around and go, we actually saved X million because what we did was we invested in the workforce up front, and by being able to look across the scope of our workforce, the output wasn't just a nice help. We didn't just reduce time to hire, right? We didn't just get better feedback on an internal survey. We actually reduced our consultancy spend by 25%, and we've been able to outlet. That, I think, is the magic dust that here that will enable that. Going back to our conversation around the C-suite, yeah. How do we get the C-suite's attention that this is something we actually need to do? Save big, big numbers on spend, which they probably know themselves. They don't really want to be spending, but they don't have a better answer for at the moment. So that's how we can help. And that's another reason, by the way, why probably a big four consultancy firm is unlikely to give the same sort of answers that we are. But that's just a personal opinion.
Yeah, Simon, I think that's a bloody brilliant point. I really do. And I haven't heard it made so articulately and so bluntly, but politely blunt, if that's okay to say that. But I was at SIA Exec Forum in London last week, and I attended a really interesting one of the sessions was on statement of work, and I guess staffing or workforce solutions companies coming into the statement of workspace. And I guess, to my mind, there's probably only two organizations that have cracked that, right, which is Allegis and Randstad, right, or the Randstad Source, right, or whatever the brand is that looks at that. And I guess you guys seem to do it really well, along with Randstad, and I'm sure there is other providers out there. There is, for go out and have a look if you want to explore that more. But it got me thinking about recruitment companies moving into that space, Simon. And it makes sense in a way, because the recruitment companies have this huge talent engine which can deliver consultants, I guess, reduce that big four consulting spend, right? And I did this myself actually 10 years ago in a previous life in a previous organization. We did it to compete with the consultancies because they were coming to us to get our resources. We could provide the resources, I guess, cheaper, faster, but crucially, we didn't and hadn't learned yet to do that better, right? So we didn't understand project governance. We didn't understand project methodology. We didn't understand pricing for risk. We didn't understand, you know, really strong statement of work and defining the scope really well. But it struck me that the staffing sector has evolved during that time period. But I guess my question is, Simon, you came into the staffing recruitment sector, I think it was 92. I might have got that wrong. Yeah, 92. And you're still a great mate, so fair play. I guess in your view, has the sector evolved for the better during that time period, Simon, with your ringside view?
Well, not enough. It's definitely evolved. On your statement of work, let's talk about the statement of work point.
Okay. Yes, please.
Because there are two very, very distinct elements, in my opinion, statement of work. And I hear what you have to say. I think it'd be remiss of me if I didn't point out, I think Allegis is probably managing two or three times as much spend under SOW as anyone else out there.
So wow.
It's significant. Under the, if you look at the Everest report on it, where they break it down, I think they've got us at between 20% and 30% and no one else at anything more than 10%. So, which I think is probably a fair reflection actually of the marketplace globally, because we've got north of 20 billion under management in SOW. But actually that isn't the answer in itself. There's two key bits. First of all, if you're managing SOW spend, there's a world of difference between headcount tracking and actually providing value in what you're doing, and yes, there's multiple layers in that. There's the first, so beyond headcount tracking is visibility, lovely to a certain extent, but there's still a bit of a patronage around the data that's in there, because you can't see everything in the way you can with staff augmentation population.
Yes.
Then next, you've got, okay, let's actually help you with the procurement here. Let's understand which vendors are doing well, which aren't doing well, because the problem is that managers have their own favourite vendors, and so what tools have we got to actually be able to look at what fits in what spend and so on. And then there's actually, are people doing what they said they were going to do? Is it, you know, is it being done on time? Is it being done to the cost that was, if it was going to be done, is it going to be done to the standard, whatever the services are, the standard that were promised? And if you're going to add value in SOW, you need to be doing that lot. You need to be doing all of that, those elements, rather than just headcount tracking. And my personal opinion is that organisations go out and they talk about they're doing SOW. They're basically doing headcount tracking plus a few other little bits around the side. And therefore, if I was an organisation, I'd go, well, where's the value in that? Okay, so yeah, we've got to, and that's on us, by the way. That's on us as an industry,
yes,
to demonstrate value. But the point that you just flagged there around staffing businesses delivering services. So
yes,
I've worked in three big staffing businesses, and two of those three were not interested in taking the risk associated with taking the risk for work products, basically,
yes,
the outputs of the individual. So we'll never go there. Allegis takes a different view. It doesn't sit within Allegis Global Solutions. It sits within the staffing side of the business.
Ah.
It is far and away the fastest growing area of the business, actually delivering those. And where that model came from was 100% what you said. It's, yeah, basically saying, well, they were supplying. We had an example where within technology, these individuals could be provided to a client at X price. They could also be provided to one of the big consultancy firms at 2x price.
Yes.
And they're provided at 2x price to the same end company, and then they're probably getting another 2x on top of that. Yeah. So they're four times as expensive. Or maybe the margin's four times and the total cost is double or triple, something like that. And it's the same person doing the same work. Well, how broken? We've actually got one client as an example at the moment where we've had vendors refuse to supply in one particular geography under the staff augmentation. And they openly said to us, it's because we can supply the same people via the statement of work route for three times the price. So why would we do that? Okay. So the model is broken. Okay.
Yeah.
By the way, if you've just joined and you missed the first bit, listen to the bit about harmonization, which is why that's a really bad idea. And we can fix that. But within our staffing businesses, the tech systems in particular, across a number of them, they're basically going, hang on a minute. The consultancies, they have expertise on the ground. They know how to price and they know how to manage risk, but they don't have access to the people, which is actually the really hard
thing. Yeah, correct.
We have got access to the people. All we need to do is make sure that we understand risk and we understand how to deliver, and we've got some management on the ground to actually make this happen. And that's what they've done. And they've got a strategic advantage because we can access the people so much more cost effectively and flexibly than the consultancies can themselves. So I do think that'll be a future model, but it's a future model for those organisations that have got the appetite for risk. And I totally appreciate that that's not everyone. I mean, and it doesn't have to be everyone. It will just be certain organisations that want to go down that path. But it's certainly a very successful model.
Yeah, I agree, Simon. And having tried it, failed, and then been successful at it 10 years ago, it was quite the journey. We went from doing it for a large telco provider in Ireland. Pretty simple. They want their work packages. Then we tried it with the world's largest car manufacturer in the UK, and we lost our shirts, right? So there's a good lesson learned. Don't ever price things up on a fixed price basis with no overage. But anyway, that's not the purpose of the podcast, I guess. But anyone considering it, be well worth the scope it out properly and price it, price the risk accordingly. But some of the figures you mentioned there, Simon, are truly impressive. About 20 billion underspend in statement of work spend. That is bloody off the charts. Love to get you on more, actually, again, Simon. There's so many things we've enjoyed discussing during the show, and they lead off in tangents. But love to discuss that in more detail on a future show with you. But, Simon, one of the things, if you look at the three tenets of the universal workforce model, relates to, can a task be automated potentially, right? And I really wanted to ask you what your thoughts are in relation to automation. Do you feel that automation is likely to have a negative impact on jobs and jobs displacement, or is there an upside to automation in your view?
The history of, so automation is not new. Okay. It's been happening, you know, otherwise I haven't got it in front of me, but I have a photograph on my desk where people talk about the risk association of a policeman manually operating a traffic light in the middle of a intersection to basically say, well, you know, we'd still be here, okay, if we didn't have automation of that.
Yeah.
The history of automation is almost exclusively the history of providing work opportunity and increasing employment, not of decreasing employment. The best example, and again, one of the reasons why we work with John Boudreau, who with Ravi Chapuzra, and articulates this brilliantly in their books, cashiers in banks, in retail banks. So the data on this is absolutely unequivocal. Best example of it. You'd think that when ATMs came in, that we would, because the primary role of cashiers was to basically hand out cash, you think we'd need far fewer cashiers. Well, we have far more cashiers than we had. They're not just cashiers anymore. Their jobs are much more interesting. That manual element of their role has been taken out, has been automated. And that's what automation does. It makes organizations more efficient. It makes jobs more interesting. And because the organizations are more efficient, it creates employment opportunities. I could give other examples of that. So I think that the challenge, by the way, what's caused the displacement of work is globalization. Right? Now, that's, you can argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And we also had the Africa conversation a little earlier on. But it is an automation. Automation creates opportunities. And it's very hard to find an example where that's not the case. The flaw in automation, in my humble opinion, is that people try to automate a whole role. And really, the secret to automation is breaking things down to a task level and then automating an individual task and then using that opportunity to make the individual's job more interesting and more productive, hence more employment. Okay, that's the story of automation. That's where automation works. You try and automate, you try and go, we're going to automate all those roles over there. You won't get there because it's too hard and too complicated. Task level, automate a task, everyone wins. And I, yes, I am slightly oversimplifying, but actually the history of automation is broadly what I've just outlined.
Yeah, Simon, I'm inclined to see it from your point of view. And also, I think from my research on this topic, humans aren't built for task management, right? We don't think in the way of tasks, right? But machines can. Machines can manage tasks or some tasks exceptionally well and much better than any human can. I mean, that's why a lot of airplanes have task management software in their planes, because humans aren't typically very good at monitoring this, monitoring that, monitoring. Our attention wanders and wanes, and you know, we're more creative, I guess, than that. So I'm inclined to subscribe to your point of view. But, Simon, you might have heard of this guy already, Vasily Leontief, and he was, a Georgian or Russian labour market economist, right? We're getting quite esoteric on the podcast today, Simon. But in short, back in the 60s and 70s, he looked at the role of horses, right, in New York City, pre the internal combustion engine, pre-automation in a way. And what he found was that once the internal combustion engine had been adopted and adopted widely, then there was no need for horses. And his thesis, and by the way, I'm overly simplifying this, of course, for myself and our audience, is that humans have the potential to be the new horses as a result of automations. Now, that's quite a dystopian, I appreciate, but just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, I would challenge it on the grounds. I think it's very fair to say that there would be so the horse's entire role has been automated in that example, and the horse is not able to adapt to do something else at scale, which of course the reason humans are frankly the dominant species on the planet is because they can. So I think that there is, because of that adaptation point, and because we have the ability to not, and as I said, what I'm advocating is not really, is that the secret isn't to have, is to automate the whole role. It's automate an element of it and make the job more interesting, more productive. So I think that the two analogies are not completely disconnected, but I could pull up those two reasons that I just did there as to why one is one and one is the other. That's not to say that when you go down the route of automation, there might be certain individuals or people that have got a particularly individual skill, or people that don't want to retrain, and it's very, you know, therefore that it could have a damaging impact. That's true, but the reality is that you can't even though for that individual at a micro level that is potentially deeply traumatic and unsettling, and has personal trauma associated with it, you can't say, well, therefore we're not going to automate, and therefore we're not going to progress, and therefore we're not going to move forward, because then that's where my policeman operating traffic lights by switching levers comes into play, because otherwise you just end up there and no one wants that. And see, that actually isn't good for anyone. Hard to say though it is when you look at an individual micro example.
Yes.
It's not good for anyone to say, well, actually, what happened to those policemen? What are they doing now? Okay, well, they'd have moved on and gone and done other things. And that might sound glib, but at a macro level, that's what we have to do. And there's no, I don't think there's any point shying away from that.
Yeah, I'm with you, Simon. I think that's a fair point. And I think I know what my Christmas card might be this year. I think it might be that picture that you've referred to a number of times. So I love it. But Simon, I've got two final questions, if I can. The next one, if it's okay, relates to remote work. And I'm going to try and simplify this question somewhat, but maybe I'll give you some context. I've led a remote first and fully distributed business for the last 7 years. And it works for us and it works for me, right? But I feel incredibly privileged in a way that it has worked and that we're able to do this. But I often think about the deskless workers, the factory technicians, the policeman or woman or police person, the army, the people that are making medicines, the people who are sweeping the streets, the barista, the barman or woman. They don't got that opportunity, I suppose. Or maybe they could have that opportunity. Maybe they could seek that opportunity. Maybe they could get trained for that opportunity. But I'm somewhat conflicted really around remote work, and there's been a debate of sorts, which I'll boil it down to its simplest terms. There's the remote work zealots that are out there, Simon, that say it's the best thing since sliced bread and no organization or people can ever go back to that. And then there's the people that say, well, hang on a minute, maybe people do need that connection in a work and or a, some sort of office environment. So I suppose, Simon, my question really is, where do you sit in terms of the debate? What's your take on this?
I don't wring my hands over worrying about different roles as just different in their nature. You know, an air stewardess is never going to be able to work from home and do their job. Right. End of conversation. And some people will love that and deeply want to do it because they love that sort of job. And other people will not love that. Well, then they won't become air stewardesses. I think that the same with barista and policeman. And, you know, you never, you know, realistically, you can't be a professional rugby player at home, right? That's a video games player, right? So just, you know, we can keep going. But that doesn't worry me because I think individuals are going to make their choice around that. I think that the debate is more for those roles that are potentially open, and we see this in our organisation, potentially open for remote working, what's the right balance? So we had some feedback recently internally, people saying it doesn't feel quite the same as it did pre-pandemic. I don't feel I've got quite the connection to my fellow employees, and recruitment being such a, you know, interpersonal business, people yes. business. I don't feel quite the same connection that I did before, and that worries me. And then they were asked, this individual was asked, how often do you come into the office? And they went, about one day a fortnight. And so those two factors are not unconnected. And the truth is there's a balance to be struck. And that balance is going to vary from role to role. So I don't wring my hands over comparing role to role because they're just different. But I do think that for individual positions or office-based positions where you've got that privilege and you could frankly do either, for me the most interesting thing is that the original argument for you should be in the office was one of productivity. Well, in the recruitment industry, not staff industry, in the outsourcing recruitment industry, certainly in our organisation, productivity isn't the reason anymore because people are actually more productive at home. They get more done. They tend to work later. They tend to start earlier. You know, they don't have time in between meetings at dead time, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not about that, but it is about the human connection. It is about your long-term buy-in to an organisation. It's about actually having a job is about more than just doing work. And therefore, you need to have a balance. But we don't want to dictate in our organisation what that balance is because it's just going to vary. Right? What is it, 2 days? Is it 3 days? Is it four? Well, who's to say? So I think that we've got to do that. But what I would say is, though, that I think over time, people are realising and leaders are having to realise that bringing people back into the office for interpersonal connection reasons is a really good thing. You're actually sacrificing a bit of productivity by doing that. That's still a good thing to do. And probably, personal opinion, the balance, people are a little bit too much work from home still, he says, doing the podcast from home. but, you know, it's Monday, and it just so happens. So you know, there's a balance to be struck there. I wouldn't try and be prescriptive about what that balance is, and I wouldn't want to wring my hands over industry to industry.
Yeah, fair play, Simon, and thanks for being so candid. And I really love your answer, actually. So thanks for that. So, Simon, we're going to finish if we may with a question we ask all of our guests. It's a fairly straightforward question, but the answers always intrigue us. So the question is, Simon, what, if any, is your prediction for the future of work?
When we wrote the book, we could have called it The Future of Work. we didn't, but I think it's squarely in the topic of the future of work. I'm interpreting what you're asking, Connor, as how do organisations get work done? Okay. As opposed to what's it like being in employment, because we've just touched on that a little bit and so on. What I think, my first prediction is that the topic of the workforce will become a topic that is being talked around the boardroom and the practical connection between what does an organisation want to achieve at a strategic level to achieve its objectives, and what are we actually doing with our workforce, will become much more closely connected. And at the moment, they are disconnected in almost every case. Okay. Quick example, internal recruitment. How many organizations do we know that go, well, I understand that if I retain my people, I get better productivity than hiring externally. Therefore, internal recruitment's really, really important to us. Therefore, we're going to promote internal recruitment, and that's going to become a priority for us. Very high percentage of organizations would subscribe to that at a board level. How many organizations then on the ground make it harder to apply for an internal job than for an external job by saying, here are the rules that apply around internal applications. By the way, none of these rules apply for an external application. You don't have to tell your manager when you're applying for an external job, because you don't have to have been here a certain amount of time. You know, so there's that's my example of a disconnect, right? We want to achieve one thing, and then we put policies in place that achieve completely the opposite, and we don't realise that we've done it, and everyone does it. So my prediction is that there will be a coming together of executive leadership, C-suite individuals, understanding at a practical level what do we actually do in relation to our workforce, and making sure that the activities that are taking place support the broader objectives in organisation, and we get better productivity, frankly happier workforces as a result of that. And the book that we produced is trying to articulate a part of that, but not all of it.
Wow. Simon, that sounds like a powerful and convincing manifesto for change. And just want to say, Simon, I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with yourself and Bruce today. Congratulations to you both on writing a really phenomenal book. It's really right place, right time. So congratulations to you both. And thanks ever so much to you both for your time. Simon, where is the best place for our audience to purchase the book and to reach out to you?
Yeah, so I'll tell you how to get it. What I would say is we actually haven't put it up for sale, because it wasn't about making money out of the book sale. It was about getting the story out of there. So it's available free of charge. The best place to go for it is www.universalworkforcemodel.com. It's available for electronic download, and we do have hard copies available as well. And if you wanted to request a hard copy, and we will send one to you. But that's essentially it. The only other thing I will say, if I may, is Bruce and I have done Bruce hosts a podcast called Subject to Talent, and we've talked about some of these issues on that as well. And if anyone's particularly interested in some of the details around that, listening to the Subject to Talent podcast would give a little bit more information around some of that stuff as well. But that universalworkforcemodel.com is the best place to get hold of a copy.
Wonderful, Simon. We'll be sure to link both in the show notes as well. But Simon, we're wishing you a very happy holiday or Christmas season ahead. And thanks so much to you both for joining the show. I appreciate you're both very busy. So all the best, Simon. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks again ever so much. Take care.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Bye.
That was great. Thanks. Thank you.